The terrorist attacks on Paris sparked an outpouring of love and support for the people affected. The terrorist attacks on Beirut the day before did not. This hour, we'll try to understand why some events spark empathy and others don't. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Daryl Cameron is the director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. From a neighbor in need to violence in a city to widespread famine to the people fleeing a brutal civil war to the victims of terrorism, we'll try to understand why we respond the way we do. I'll also talk with Rebecca Renzi, high school counselor at Waterloo East High School, about teaching empathy to young people. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Following the terrorist attacks on Paris, profile pictures on Facebook transformed to a wave of blue, white, and red, the French flag, along with an artistic rendering of the Eiffel Tower as a peace sign. The act of millions of individuals showing their support for Paris in this way has launched many different conversations about how we respond to world events in the 21st century. And this hour, we're going to have a conversation about empathy and morality. Daryl Cameron is here with me. He's the director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. Daryl, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Now, before we get started, I think we should define our terms. When we talk about empathy, what do we mean?
So psychologists and neuroscientists tend to define empathy in the following way. So they define it as vicariously kind of sharing what other people are going through. So if I see someone who's crying, I will immediately and automatically catch that sadness myself. So And that's different from compassion. So compassion is a distinct state. That psychologists think is it's more of a – instead of a feeling with someone else, it's more of a feeling for.
Okay. So sympathy.
Exactly.
And empathy and sympathy, empathy and compassion, these are linked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, empathy can lead to compassionate acts. Why is it more powerful than sympathy?
Well, much research is trying to figure out, you know, which of these emotional states is more powerful, under what circumstances do they come apart and predict different things. Many would argue that sympathy and compassion are actually quite powerful. If you want to get people to, you know, help others, to donate, to be cooperative, getting them to feel sympathy or compassion is really what you want to do. Some would argue that simply sharing what other people are feeling, this kind of affect of empathy, may not always be enough.
Now, I mentioned the Paris attacks, and one of the things that came up immediately following the Paris attacks, as all of those Facebook profile pictures changed colors, some people were angry because people reacted this way to the terrorist attacks in Paris, and yet the day before the terrorist attacks in Paris, there had been terrorist attacks in Beirut, in Lebanon, and people did not react the same way. So when there – and of course, some people said, oh, the media didn't cover it. The media covered it, but people didn't share those stories about Beirut. It wasn't everywhere the way that the attacks on Paris were. What's the difference? Why did the Paris attacks evoke this mass outpouring and the attacks in Beirut did not?
It's a really fascinating question, and I think – from a psychological perspective, and this is not to speak to any individual person's choice of what to post on Facebook, but on average, people tend to feel less empathy and less compassion or sympathy for people who are unlike them, for people who are dissimilar along any dimension. It could be values, nationality, ethnicity, gender, and so forth. So one argument from a psychological perspective is that what's happening here is we have an easier time kind of imagining what it's like to be a Parisian going through that attack. It might be harder to put ourselves in the shoes of someone in Beirut. So that's certainly one possibility. Something else to consider, too, is that it may be that different expectations about levels of violence in these different places may be part of what's going on. There's some work to suggest that people, when they find a crisis or tragedy like this to be unexpected, like it is in Paris, perhaps, there's a stronger empathic and compassion response to that.
Do people experience empathy fatigue? If you're following events in the Middle East, for example, and there have been you know, so many incidents where people are being murdered, being thrown out of their homes, being attacked by terrorists. Do we just run out of empathy?
So that's a, I mean, that's a fascinating question, and it's one that is currently being hotly debated by psychologists, philosophers. Many would suggest that, yes, you know, we have to be strategic about where we feel empathy. And it may be that we simply have only so much empathy to go around, kind of like a fixed pie, so to speak. And if we care about Paris, it makes it less easy for us to care about Beirut. But others argue that actually you can choose to feel empathy for these other cases. It's just that you're choosing to prioritize those who are similar to you.
Let's move away from the recent terrorist attacks. I want to talk about a moment in September where suddenly people seem to start caring about the refugee crisis in Europe. And although we had been hearing stories on NPR and if you follow media, reading stories about the refugee crisis for months and knowing that people were drowning and people were dying, there was that moment in early September when the image of a 3-year-old Syrian boy who had drowned and washed up on the beach, that image was everywhere. And that was a moment that really evoked a lot of empathy, I think, everywhere. Why was that so much more powerful than all of those other stories?
So I mean, I shared the reaction. I saw the image and I had the same visceral reaction that I'm sure many did. As the father of a 3-year-old son, I immediately related to that and it really gripped me. One reason from a psychological perspective is that we are often immensely compelled by individualized single victims. So if I see, you know, the drowned boy or using another recent example, the different case, Cecil the Lion, identifiable named victim, those are often quite powerful elicitors of empathy and compassion.
Right. So there have been stories about poaching of African animals for a very long time. And when Cecil got poached, suddenly everybody cared.
And there was a story in The New York Times not too soon after that event when someone pointed out that, you know, annually roughly 100,000 animals are killed in a similar way. They don't have a name. They don't have like a personality they're ascribed. But they don't seem to trigger the same kind of outrage that Cecil did. And then again, more recently, you know, hundreds of thousands of Syrians are suffering similar plights as this boy, and yet they don't seem to elicit the same kind of outrage. So a lot of psychologists suggest that this is kind of a fundamental feature of how empathy is built. You know, we just our radio wavelengths are tuned to respond to single victims. But when it comes to hundreds or thousands, we just don't seem to be as capable of that response.
Is it because we don't feel capable of doing anything? Are the numbers so overwhelming that we just can't comprehend what can be done?
So that is a fascinating question, in part because that's what my lab studies. That sounds like a biased response, but it's – I mean, one argument is that we just can't feel, that you can literally run out of empathy like a finite resource, like a fossil fuel. So, you know, why would you expect me to feel empathy to the same degree for hundreds of thousands of people? It's simply impossible is the argument for some. My lab has put forward a different perspective, namely that we often choose not to feel. We may feel that, well, could I really do anything for that many people? Is it just a drop in the bucket? If I let myself feel, would it just be emotionally exhausting and fatiguing? My favorite kind of anecdotal example of this, so there's the famous SPCA commercial with Sarah McLachlan. She's singing Angel, you know, in the arms of the angel. And there's pictures of just abused animals, puppies and kittens. It's really emotionally excruciating. And she made this commercial. And she's been on record saying afterwards that I can't even watch this. Like, I care so much about animals, but I can't actually put myself through the experience of it because it's so excruciating. So the work that I've done suggests that oftentimes people will essentially change the channel. They'll choose what to look at, what to attend to, what kind of media to read. And that dictates a large part of the scope of their empathy.
Now, you have done research specifically using examples from the Darfur region of Sudan, where, of course, so much suffering and so many individuals, so many children suffering for so many years. And you set up a study where you would communicate with people in the study about children in this region. Tell me what you did.
So we had participants come into our laboratory, and we told them about the crisis in Darfur, just the suffering that's existing over there. And we told them, well, look, here is one child refugee, or here are eight child refugees. And past work suggests that people will feel less empathy and compassion or sympathy for eight than for one. Mm-hmm. It's the same kind of drop-off from an identifiable victim to a larger number. And we thought, well, you know, prior work has found this effect. It seems to be something you see in the lab but also in the field. It's pretty robust. Can we move it around? So according to some, we can run out of empathy. And so when faced with the suffering of eight child refugees, we just can't feel more. It's just kind of a built-in glitch or bug in our empathy response. But we thought, well, what if we change what people want to feel? So we gave half of participants, in addition to manipulating how many victims there were, we gave half of participants the expectation that, look, later on in the study, we're going to ask you how much money you'd donate to help the children in Darfur. The other half of participants, we simply removed that expectation. So they didn't think there was a kind of a price tag on the compassion response. And what we found was that when people expected to have to engage in costly pro-social behavior to help these children, they showed more compassion for one child than for eight. But this reversed when you remove that expectation of having to help.
Interesting.
So that suggests that by changing what people want to feel, we can change whether we run out of empathy, essentially.
So it sounds like people were protecting themselves. If
Correct.
I think this is going to cost me money, mm-hmm. I'm going to engage with this less emotionally.
Exactly. And there's a variety of other work in the field that is, you know, very similar. If you change people's expectations about what empathy is going to be like, is it going to be emotionally rewarding? Do the people I care about value empathy? You can change whether people seek out and choose to feel that emotion.
Well, are there people who are more likely to be empathetic than other people?
Yes. So this has been a topic that has fascinated psychologists for many years and folks outside of psychology too. One factor that I think is especially interesting is socioeconomic status. So this is work by my friend Paul Piff out at UC Irvine. And he finds across a variety of studies that people who are higher in socioeconomic status, where that means income, wealth, education level, but also those who subjectively feel like they're better off than others, they tend to show reduced empathy and compassion across a variety of situations. So the argument for that is that people who are higher in SES are basically more independent. They have less need to rely upon the desires and states of others. But folks who are lower in SES have to kind of work with others cooperatively in order to get ahead.
Interesting. So they would have more empathy for other people as well.
They would have more empathy.
Because they understand their connection.
And they need empathy in order to survive.
Interesting. Well, we will talk more about this in a moment. This hour, we're talking about empathy and morality. Daryl Cameron is the director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about empathy and morality. A lot of questions have been asked about why we respond the way that we do to world events in the last couple of weeks. And this hour, we're trying to understand that. With me, Daryl Cameron. He's director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. Also, Rebecca Renzi is here. She's a high school counselor at Waterloo East High School. Hello, Rebecca.
Good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we wanted you to be a part of the program today because the idea of developing empathy or at least connecting with young people and their empathy, I think, is a fascinating part of this conversation as well. And starting with the recent current events, how have you seen the high school students that you work with responding to the attacks on Paris?
I know they're really interested. A lot of people might think that high school students aren't really thinking about the current events, but I've heard several conversations or snippets of conversations. I haven't been part of those conversations, but I know that they are very interested in the social justice issues of it.
Well, and an event like the attacks on Paris is something that gets so much attention that even high school students who aren't paying attention to current events probably hear about it, right?
Right, right. And, you know, Facebook helps. They're always on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. So anything that's posted widely on there, they're going to get themselves involved in.
Now, there are many problems that high school students encounter that are much more real and present for them than terrorist attacks in Europe.
Right.
And responding to conflicts with empathy can really help students a great deal. How do you cultivate empathy in a teenager?
Well, empathy really can be a learned behavior, even in a teenager. And to teach empathy, you really have to model it. So one of the biggest ways that I teach empathy is to model it to them. You know, many adults don't think that they even have the time to listen to a young person's point of view, no matter what the situation. I always try to take the time to listen to that point of view, even if I think that that point of view is a little skewed. There are often times when I might be sitting across from a teenager who is struggling with something that I don't think is a major deal, like a fourth breakup in 2 months. And there's an adult voice in me that says, hey, you know, it's just a high school romance. You're going to get over it. But that empathic voice has to take over. And that's when that kind of I coach myself through that. Like, this is really important to them at this time. And they feel like their life is over. And so I ask myself questions when I'm struggling with my own empathy, like, am I saying or doing things in a way that would make my children want to listen to me and learn from me? Or would I want anyone to speak to me the way that I'm speaking to them? Or even what choices am I making for them? And how would they feel about those choices? And I think coaching yourself through that empathy and modeling it is really the first step to teaching it.
Do you think that children need to be taught to be empathetic?
I think it might be naturally inherent for some students, but there are other students who might not have a lot of empathy in their home situations. And so that's where, you know, if they're working through a conflict with another student, that's where I step in and coach them through that so that they have those skills.
And give me an example of how you would coach someone to feeling empathetic.
I generally try to focus on two things. One is called, I call it intent versus impact. I try to teach the young people that they have to evaluate the intent versus the impact of their words. So they might not have meant for someone to be hurt by their words or their actions or their Facebook status. And in the end, they're still responsible for the impact of their words and actions. So I might ask a student to put themselves in the shoes of the other person involved, and I will ask them to think, how might they have taken your words or your actions or your Facebook status? If they didn't know what you were thinking, how could they have known that you didn't have any ill intent? Or what information might you provide them so that he or she isn't making an assumption about your intent? And then making assumptions is the second piece that I use when coaching a young person through a conflict, because assumptions really create a negative script in our head where we color every word or interaction with that negative filter. Teaching kids about making assumptions versus collecting facts or evidence helps them to keep that more positive script in their head, which makes empathy more possible. If you're thinking negative thoughts, you're not likely to be empathetic toward another person. And if you have a positive script running through your head, you're more likely to be empathetic.
Working with teenagers, I mean, teenagers are not a group of people that are sort of famous for their social intelligence. Is it a particular challenge at this age, with all of the changes that teenagers are going through, to get them to stop and think about how someone else feels?
I believe it can be. Quite often, they come to me really, really angry. And if someone's really angry, it's going, even if it's yourself and you're trying to work with someone else, it's really hard to be empathetic at that moment in time. And so trying to teach them, first of all, maybe basic anger management skills, coping with your own anger and how you can calm yourself down, then, you know, you can focus a little bit more on the other pieces of the empathy and conflict resolution.
Before the break, Daryl and I were talking about research that shows that people of a higher socioeconomic level, people in positions of power, tend to be less empathetic. And Daryl, let me ask you, and then I'll follow up with you, Rebecca. What about people in low socioeconomic conditions, people who have so many problems to worry about on their own that thinking about the problems of other people is not very high on their list of things to do?
So that's a great question.
Oh, just a moment. Your microphone. Here we go. Now.
Okay. Sorry. So that's a great question. And I do think that more work needs to be done to examine those who are experiencing severe socioeconomic deprivation. Much of the laboratory work that I briefly alluded to was looking at those for who are not severely depressed. That said, I think that, many situations for people who don't have the wherewithal or the resources and don't really have the time, I mean, that can introduce other competing inhibitors to empathy and compassion. To the degree that people feel that they just simply, they have to put focus on their immediate family or they have to focus on just getting paycheck to paycheck. I mean, those could be factors that would mute empathy in day-to-day life. So I'm going to hedge the kind of scientific answer, which is more work needs to be done to look at whether at the extreme low ends of the SES spectrum, if there are factors that would legitimately get in the way of choosing to feel empathy.
And Rebecca, do you want to weigh in on that? Because you deal with students who have a lot of problems in their lives, who are on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, who may come from a very difficult background. Is it harder to feel empathy when you're struggling yourself?
I think it depends on their situation. I've seen some students who, they're in survival mode. And so for them, they're just trying to make it through the day. They're trying to make it through the next hour of classes without trying to focus on what's going on at home or what's going on outside at work or whatever the problem is that's following them into school. But I've also had some kids who have overcome things like homelessness or just being so far behind that they don't even think they're going to graduate because they still have 2 years of work left and they're senior. And they're some of the students that I'll turn to sometimes to help out other kids who are struggling because they've been in those shoes, because they have shown that they can, persevere and they're resilient. And I think resilience is a big key. If they have a lot of qualities of resilience, then, they might be able to see beyond their survival mode and help out other people or to care about other people as well.
Do you think that there's a window of opportunity for people to learn to be empathetic? Is this something we have to learn when we're young?
I don't think so. Most of my work is with teenagers. I used to teach in elementary and middle school. And really, teenagers, they're still sponges. And so they're still soaking up things. They're still looking to you and watching you. I have a lot of kids who will ask me, why are you so nice to everybody all the time? And really, they're watching you all the time at home, at school, wherever it is. And so if they have positive people to witness and to learn from, I think that they can learn it even as teenagers.
Daryl, is there research about, from your perspective, about different ages and different levels of empathy?
So not being a developmentalist, I caution against strong statements here. But, I mean, it is interesting to think about, do we start kind of intuitively being very empathic and compassionate for others? And then over time, we kind of see, other reasons and inhibitions for why we should not feel empathy. Are we naturally kind of outgoing and agreeable? But then as we learn about these different kinds of costs that empathy and compassion might entail, do we kind of prune back who we feel empathy for? On the other hand, I think the point about resilience is very well taken. I think that as you grow older and learn how to self-regulate and become more aware of your feelings and the situations in which you feel you have these different responses, you can manage yourself in a way that sometimes can allow for greater expression of empathy. If you can kind of shut down the survival mode, so to speak, as you mature and gain self-regulatory abilities, you can allow yourself to feel empathy in ways that maybe earlier on in your life you could not have.
I'm talking with Daryl Cameron. He's director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. Also with us, Rebecca Renzi, high school counselor at Waterloo East High School. We're talking about empathy and morality this hour. Can empathy be learned? Why do some events evoke empathy where other events around the world do not? We'd love to hear from you, and we'd love to hear your questions as well. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have an email from Dave. He says, I do have a question for your guest. You seemingly hesitated to state what seems to me to be the biggest cause here, the inherent, if unconscious, racism in U.S. society. Your explanations seem to hint at it, at least, talking about how we don't care as much about the other. Empathy fatigue and reduced empathy seem to flow right into that. Can you comment on what part and how much you think racism is a factor?
So, I mean, generally in psychology, there's been a lot of work on kind of intergroup biases in empathy. I mean, generally, we feel reduced empathy for people who are dissimilar to us in some way. So if I'm a Boston Red Sox fan, perish the thought, you know, I may have lower empathy for the suffering of Yankees, New York Yankees fans. Now, that said, whether we want to call that prejudice or stereotyping, that different sides have different kind of interpretations or what we should call that. And as for whether it's inherent, I guess my response would be that we don't always have to show this intergroup empathy bias, even if it does reflect our basic tendency to kind of categorize in-group versus out-group. It's something that we can correct if we want to. So there's plenty of work that finds that if you get people to want to feel empathy for those who are dissimilar from us, they appear capable of doing so.
But it also seems like an out for people. If the group who is suffering is not like me, maybe I don't have to feel empathetic. I mean, that seems like a place where a lot of our problems come from.
And that's true. There was actually about a few years ago, there was a meta-analysis of studies looking at interracial differences in helping behavior. So if you're in an emergency situation and someone's in need of help and it's either a Caucasian or an African-American, you know, what are the factors that produce differences in that compassionate empathic response? And what they found was really interesting, and it speaks to what you were just saying, that when people have some kind of out, some kind of rationalization not related to race that they can use for justifying not helping, it's like, oh, it's going to cost too much or it wouldn't make that big of a difference. That's when you see these race-related biases and empathic outcomes coming about. So all that is to say, I think that, I mean, you can view, you know, intergroup bias and stereotypes and race as often playing a role in empathy, and they do. What I would challenge is whether this has to be the case and whether it has to be kind of inherent or, you know, something that is some kind of basic glitch in empathy.
Well, it seems like if people are doing it unconsciously coming up with other reasons to express a racial bias, and that sounds like something that would be incredibly difficult to overcome.
That's correct. So, and there's much work in social psychology that focuses on unconscious race, like racial biases and stereotypes. And they, you know, they encourage people to do consciousness raising, to try to figure out, you know, take tests to learn about any of these subtle associations that you have with different groups. So there are ways to kind of raise your own biases, if you have any, into conscious awareness. And the hope is that once you're aware of this possibility, that, well, maybe my empathy is a little bit tilted towards those who are like me, you have the choice to change.
Rebecca, you work at Waterloo East High School, which is a very diverse school. So you work with children of many different backgrounds, a large African-American population, of course, a large Caucasian population. This is
right.
Iowa.
Yep.
Many young people who are the children of Bosnian refugees. Mm-hmm. You also have many Hispanic students as well. And that's in many ways a tremendous opportunity because people from different backgrounds get to know each other. And hopefully that leads to a better future. But do you see this as also a problem that you experience trying to help young people look past racial or ethnic biases to be empathetic to other students?
Yes and no. I mean, with high schoolers, you know, a lot of it comes down to the different types of activities that you're involved in. So if, you know, there are students of different races on the same team and, you know, they they're going to have that team mentality with their teammates. And so I think in high school, a lot of times it boils down to your interests and activities when we're talking about if you have more empathy towards people who are alike versus people who are different. In high school, a lot of it comes to what kinds of things you're involved in and what your interests are. You know, you have the kids who are involved in band and who are involved in drama. And so you might see a little less empathy across those groups. As far as racial differences go, I don't notice a whole lot going on. I'm sure that there is. And that's just something that you'd have to coach a student through because it might be learned from home. And they're bringing it to school with them. But I can't think of anything specific example as far as racial differences go.
Racism has been a topic of conversation. I guess that's an understatement in the media in the United States in the last year and a half in some very striking ways. Do kids bring that to school? Are they paying attention to that, Rebecca?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. When something like that happens or with some of the things that have gone on in our community, they do bring that with them. And, you know, it's interesting to have conversations with students about that, you know, even just one-on-one, their views on things. I was working with a young man who was writing an essay for a scholarship on how he could change the image of an African-American male. And it was really great conversation to have with him.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Rebecca Renzi, high school counselor at Waterloo East High School, and Daryl Cameron, director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. You're welcome to join the conversation as well. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about empathy and morality in the wake of current events, but also just in daily life. With me, Daryl Cameron. He's the director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. Rebecca Renzi is here, a high school counselor at Waterloo East High School. And you are welcome to join the conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Tom is on the line. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi there. What would you like to talk about?
Well, my 13-year-old daughter has just gone through a life-threatening illness, and she's come out the other side of it really with a lack of empathy that I didn't expect after her going through what she's been through. Within her own group, she, you know, shows empathy with other kids that are going through what she's gone through. But outside of that, she just has no time for the other drama of her peers.
Oh, interesting. I'm so glad she's doing well, Tom. Let me Rebecca respond to that first. Is that something you've seen with young people who've been through really, really difficult circumstances?
Typically, I think at first they might have maybe a lack of empathy. I mean, if you said she's showing empathy to her close friends, but maybe not to people outside her circle, you know, she might be just trying to cling to the people that she cares about the most at this point in time as she's still possibly recovering from a trauma.
Well, and with what she has been through, I mean, I can imagine that really does put things in perspective. Tom, you said she doesn't have much patience for the kind of drama that some other people are going through. Does she?
Right.
Is she able to say, well, that's going to pass? That's not a big deal?
Right. With what, you know, with all that she's been through with, you know, chemotherapy, it was leukemia that she's a survivor of. And with everything she's been through, she just has no time for hair drama or boyfriend drama or the other things that, you know, her peers are going through.
And is that creating problems for her?
I think a little bit. I think she's had a hard time. She had to spend quite a bit of time out of school, and as she's got back into school and has tried to assimilate with her group, I think it's been hard for her to fit in now that she's, you know, not seeing things the same way they're seeing things.
It's so interesting that you're asking this question. Rebecca, so often we try to help young people empathize with someone like Tom's daughter who's been through this life-threatening event,
right,
as opposed to trying to help someone who's been through an experience that many of us can't understand, empathize with those of us who are just going about our normal, average, everyday lives.
Well, and really, she went through an adult experience. You know, a lot of our students go through adult experiences, and you really don't typically think of a child having to go through something like that. And that can cause them to mature a little bit more than their peers and make it hard for them to find their space back in their peers because they've had this life-changing experience that really usually an adult handles.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I'm so glad your daughter's doing well. And Rebecca, it sounds like you feel like she's going to be okay.
I think she'll, you know, it might take her some time, but I think she'll find her way eventually and how to navigate those waters of having that experience, but then fitting back in. And she might just not want to deal with drama. I mean, I don't want to deal with drama daily, so that's a good thing.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for your call. And now we've got Ron on the line in Ely. Hi, Ron.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Sort of a follow-up with the previous caller. The show on the brain, public broadcasting's had talked about a man who had to think consciously about every motion involved with walking because of something bad that had happened to his brain. We don't get better at walking by thinking about, you know, taking each step and managing like he had to do. So in terms of, like, empathy management, you know, is there really a way to, you know, try to be more reflective about your empathy, or are you just better off cultivating virtues in yourself and your children and then having your natural life that follows from a well-formed, you know, a sense of what's right and wrong?
So you're asking, can you
second guessing yourself?
Okay, so you're saying
empathy management. What's the
okay.
point of it?
All right. So can you, should you try to think consciously about being empathetic, Daryl?
Well, that's a great question, and many would suggest that yes, there are advantages to trying to cultivate conscious awareness. And especially from the perspective that many reasons why we don't feel empathy is because we're afraid. We have reasons that we're afraid of you know, the financial cost or being exhausted or being harmed, or there's a variety of factors like that that could demotivate empathy. So if you want to feel empathy for others and you can become consciously aware of those kind of inhibitions in yourself, you can choose whether you want to act upon them. Now, as for – there was another part of your question that I thought was very interesting. It was – you know, to what degree should we kind of let ourselves kind of naturally develop in empathic directions as a function of our moral principles? And I think that's fascinating. Scientists are trying to understand, you know, what is the relationship between empathy and morality? Is it straightforward? Is it complicated? And, you know, to the degree that you embed yourself with others and you have friends and meaningful relationships, I mean, oftentimes empathy will kind of develop naturally for those who you really care about. But it's really those cases in which perhaps your propensity to feel empathy isn't quite as maybe natural. So if it's people who are dissimilar, or if it's cases like the Syrian refugee crisis where there's just so much suffering, there you might want to build your conscious awareness of what you're feeling, because it might allow you to express more empathy than you otherwise would.
That's interesting, because I feel like if, for example, if you feel sympathetic toward the Syrian refugees, then you would be more likely to explore your empathy for people. But if you're someone whose immediate response would be to say, no, they shouldn't come into this country, they're a threat to us, then you wouldn't choose to explore your empathy.
Exactly. So, I mean, if you expect that the people for whom you would feel empathy or sympathy, if you think that they're going to cause something bad to happen, then that's the kind of thing that could immediately put you into survival mode and shut down your empathic responding. But if you build awareness and realize that perhaps this is some, you know, expectation you have that you disagree with, then perhaps you override that and let yourself express empathy.
We're talking about emotional responses, which often override the rational parts of our brains. And it sounds like you're talking about two different emotional responses, the people who would immediately feel empathy and want to do something to help, or at least think someone should do something to help, or the people that feel fear and shut down and don't want to experience empathy. I think some people look at the people who are experiencing empathy and say they're being irrational. They're just being emotional. Is there something to that?
Oh, well, people on different sides of the spectrum say a lot of things. But I think that, I mean, certainly you sometimes see the critique of empathy that it's like too sentimental, that it's, you know, it's bleeding heart. You know, we couldn't possibly save everyone, so why should we try? But, you know, the value of our empathic response, you know, it's going to change depending upon what your ideology is. Certain people think that empathy is not, especially in cases like these, is not something that we should use. It's not something that should be cultivated. And disagreements about that ultimately boil down to differences in ideology and trying to figure out, well, you know, what is the right thing to do here? And ultimately, that's a moral question. That's a philosophical question that, I'll leave that to the philosophers to answer. You could try to bridge those political gaps perhaps by just trying to emphasize the common humanity of all those involved. If you can emphasize, well, look, I mean, the Syrian refugees, they're people who are just like us in so many ways. I mean, sure, there are superficial differences, but in many ways they have many of the same core values that you or I do. And emphasizing that similarity can be one useful way to boost empathy and compassion.
Do you feel like people can be blinded by their empathy?
Sometimes. There is work showing that if you feel empathy, you can sometimes become partial. So let me describe an experiment. There was one study where they led people to feel empathy and compassion for one person. It was a defendant in a hypothetical court case. And what they found is that empathy led people to actually assign a better outcome and to prefer that person, even though procedurally in terms of justice, that person should have been punished. So in some cases, if empathy makes you feel partial and kind of biased towards one specific person, that can in some cases undermine the common good. But, you know, that may just be the exception to the rule. More work needs to be done to examine, you know, under what circumstances does empathy get in the way of morality?
Here's a question from Lydia, and this is for you, Rebecca. Can you talk more about how learning empathic skills as a teenager can enhance intimate partnerships and friendships into adulthood? How might empathic skills particularly contribute to constructive conflict resolution and attunement to issues of power and control? Rebecca?
Well, you know, having an empathic response is really a key communication skill. Anytime you're talking to another person or you're in the middle of a conflict, to be able to pick up on their verbal and nonverbal cues and to understand where they're at, and that's seeking first to understand where they're at before you're understood. And I think that's a huge skill that can be used in any kind of intimate relationship later in life, at the workplace, when they're professionals, within school classes. You know, being able to first understand what somebody else is trying to tell you and then try to make yourself understood. I mean, that can be really important as a conflict resolution skill.
Here's a question from Kate. In this age of multiple streams of information and fragmenting of it, I'm wondering if that's having an impact on our sense of empathy in our culture. For example, I was listening to music and then busy at an event when the Paris attacks occurred. I heard about it hours after it happened, and I didn't hear anything about Beirut until the next day. I mean, we constantly get this barrage of information from all different sides on many different subjects. Is that impacting our ability to empathize?
Well, certainly. I mean, we live in an age of informational overload. I mean, I have, you know, roughly 10 to 15 tabs open on Safari whenever I'm online. And certainly the degree of input that we get could sometimes diminish our empathy. You know, it might kind of overwhelm our attention and diminish the sense that we could really, you know, do anything. But to the degree that One advantage of social media and other current forms, they have a way of connecting you to cases and victims in a way that we never really were able to experience in the past. You know, I can look on Facebook and see a picture of, you know, a boy who is suffering. I can see these things, and they're accessible to me in a way from across the world in a way that previously was unavailable. And I know that many at Facebook are trying to find ways to use that social media, which is so much of an important part of our life, to find conduits and channels for empathy and compassion and use it to kind of bootstrap those emotions, so to speak.
On the flip side, when people use social media, they tend to affiliate themselves with people who they have a lot of similarities with. And if people are turning to social media, Twitter or Facebook or whatever people are using, as in many ways their main source of information, they've put themselves in an echo chamber where they're hearing from other people who have the same ideas and the same feelings. I mean, that seems like that could really get in the way of empathy and communication.
Well, exactly. And one of the biggest factors that channels empathy is the norms of the groups you belong to. And if all of your friends on Facebook and Twitter kind of have a similar leaning or kind of share your values, then yes, you're not going to get exposed to the same range of, you know, empathy elicitors that perhaps someone with a different political stripe might have.
Rebecca, we're nearly out of time. We've had a couple of people want to talk about different books. This is a comment from Stephanie in Kelowna. I'm currently taking an adolescent literature class from my middle school endorsement. One of the big ideas I took away is that we can change students' perspectives by giving them great books. This can show how other people who they may not relate to as a person in reality has the same emotions that they do. Do you have some other ideas for how people can help the young people in their lives walk in someone else's shoes and experience empathy?
I think volunteering any kind of service project can be a great way to help students broaden their perspectives. I think reading books is a great way, too, because there are so many different types of experiences that are written in books that they can't just go out and have themselves. And so kind of a mixture of different things, the volunteering, the getting them into different areas that they just have never seen before, you know, whether that's a nursing home or serving at a meal for the homeless or whatever it is.
As we close out the hour, Daryl, what are some of the questions that you feel are most pressing to answer about empathy? You're doing research to understand it better.
I think the key thing is, you know, what are the limits of empathy? Is it a limited resource like fossil fuel or a gas tank? And that's important. You know, can we run out of empathy? Is it that we just can't feel empathy for everyone in the world? Is it a limit? Or is it something we choose not to feel? And in understanding whether it's a limitation on our empathy or choices we're making to disengage, that changes the sense of responsibility that we have as citizens to deal with crises both domestic and international. And if you think that empathy is a limited resource, you might very well ration it. You might think, well, you know, I can't feel empathy for everyone. You know, why should I even engage with the suffering of refugees across the world? But if you think it's a choice, that may make you have a greater sense of responsibility and choose to engage kind of rather than contract the scope of what you feel.
And you're finding that we're a lot more likely to feel empathetic if we don't think someone's going to ask us for some of our resources. That seems like possibly a troubling conclusion.
Right. So, I mean, we have to get people to find positive reasons for why empathy is a good thing. And if you encourage them to look to their peers and see how they value empathy and see it actually affecting change in the world, that's one way to get past that kind of fear.
Daryl Cameron, thank you.
Thank you.
Daryl Cameron is director of the Iowa Morality Lab and an assistant professor of social psychology at the University of Iowa. Rebecca Renzi, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Renzi is a high school counselor at Waterloo East High School. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.